Good evening, everyone. I'm Lino Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. The 2016 International AIDS Conference is well underway in Durban, South Africa. The gathering started Monday and brings together those working in the field of HIV/AIDS, as well as policymakers, persons living with HIV, and other groups committed to ending the epidemic. Well, this year's theme is Access Equity Rights Now, a call to work together and reach those who still have no access to comprehensive treatment, prevention care, and support services. More than 60% of people living with HIV have no access to antiretroviral therapy, and the conference ends on Friday. We will discuss the AIDS conference and assess the HIV/AIDS epidemic on the program today. Joining us via phone from outside Washington, D.C. in Virginia is Dr. Tom Kenyon. He is president and CEO of Project Hope, a global health education and humanitarian assistance organization. Dr. Kenyon, welcome to the show. Dr. Kenyon, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good day.
Thank you so much for joining us for this interesting discussion. We will talk to Dr. Kenyon in a moment. Let me remind our listeners that you can email us your questions or thoughts at facebook.com/healthchatvoa. We will discuss HIV very shortly, but first, Voice of America's reporter Jody Capua takes a look at the AIDS conference. Take a listen.
International AIDS Society President Chris Behrer says while much progress has been made against HIV/AIDS, much more needs to be done.
Millions of people are still being left behind. More than a million people still die of HIV/AIDS every year, and another 2 million become newly infected with HIV. Concerning data released last week show that overall, new HIV infections among adults have stalled, failing to decline for the last 5 years. Newer prevention tools like PrEP are out of reach for the great majority of people who could benefit from them.
The professor of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health is the international chair of AIDS 2016. Behrer says stigma and discrimination continue to block access to treatment and prevention.
The human rights of those at greatest risk, gay and bisexual men, transgender people, people who inject drugs, sex workers, and prisoners are persistently violated throughout the world. And these key populations now represent more than a third of new infections worldwide. That's why the theme of AIDS 2016, Access, Equity, Rights, Now, throughout this week, we'll be putting these words into action.
Also welcoming delegates to Durban is local co-chair Olive Shisana, head of the South African Human Sciences Research Council. She says in 2000, South Africa had one of the highest HIV prevalence rates in the world. She says after the conference was held in the developing world for the first time, things slowly began to change.
The landmark AIDS 2000 conference in Durban, it served as a catalyst for historic change. It launched a global movement to bring life-saving HIV treatment throughout Africa and the developing world.
She says, however, that while deaths from HIV/AIDS have fallen, it is far too soon to declare victory over the epidemic that officially began in 1981. Millions of people, she says, still need treatment. Shisana says the meeting will allow the world to take a hard look at what still needs to be done. Ban Ki-moon is attending the AIDS conference. This will be his last as UN Secretary General. Mr. Ban called for a new era to finally end the epidemic.
To end this epidemic, we must close the gaps that keep people from accessing services and living with dignity. We have to expand resources, science, and services. And we have to protect and promote the rights of people living with HIV.
The International AIDS Conference ends Friday, July 22nd. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Dr. Kenyon, again, thank you for joining us. Let me have your reaction on the report from Jody Capua. It really gave us a sense of what is happening and some of the key topics that are being discussed this year at the conference. What do you make of the conference this year?
Well, I think It's a very different time compared to when the conference was held in Durban in 2000, which myself and the delegation from Botswana, where I was stationed at the time, all attended as a team. And we were all very frustrated, discouraged, and but at the same time energized, because mortality rates were so incredibly high. We all knew something had to be done. And what Durban 2000 did was to help break the silence about improving access to services. There was denialism at many different levels, including government leadership. Of course, there was widespread stigma and discrimination that remains a problem. But following Durban 2000, there was a lot of action. The Global Fund was formed. PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, was formed by the U.S. government. Most importantly, country teams went back to their respective countries, and now that they saw that treatment was a possibility, lobbied within their own governments to actually do something, and many have, including South Africa, which invests more than $2 billion in its own epidemic per year. So Durban 2000 was a time when we were just getting the tools. Now in Durban 2016, many of the tools are at our disposal, and it's a matter of implementation and perseverance. My fear is that we could move into a period of complacency, because we're not seeing the level of mortality that we saw around the time of Durban 2000. It was unbelievably severe at the country level. In Botswana, funerals were a daily reality. We saw the best and brightest segments of the population dying away at alarming rates: teachers, health workers, soldiers, police, business persons, anybody whose life was affected by mobility in particular. We had close colleague of mine had passed away of that disease, quote unquote. And at the funeral in the home village, her relatives described how demons had reached up from the underground and brought her under. So there was really not an awareness of what was going on.
Yes.
And fellow health professionals were leaving the profession or refusing to care for AIDS patients because everyone died. It had been their experience. And at the time, treatment was available, but the drugs were more than $5,000 per year. Now they're, because of supply and demand forces, they're down to, and the support of the industry, drugs are now less than $100 per year. So it's a very different period. But my hope is that we won't forget the devastation that HIV was having at the time of Durban 2000.
Yes,
because much of that still remains.
Yes, it's very, very interesting, because when we look at how far we've come from when you were you're referring to Durban 2000, at that time you were the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention country director in Botswana. So you were able to see firsthand some of the devastation of HIV/AIDS on the ground. And although we have come so far, again, so many people talk about the fact that a lot remains to be done. And there is so many aspects of this epidemic that still need more, whether it's funding or attention even. And let's talk about the issue of access to medical care, which is the theme of this year. Again, you told us how things have improved, but to your opinion, from your experience, because you've been at the forefront of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, really, when you go back to your experience and background, what do you see as like one of the fundamentals in terms of what's blocking access to medical care for those who need it?
Well, I think with any complex question like that, you have to break it down into its components. Let's begin with accessing testing. If a person doesn't know they're HIV positive, then then they can't access services. So finding people living with HIV is the first step. And many, of course, are living without symptoms. It's an asymptomatic disease for many, many years, which is one of the sinister aspects of HIV, is that you can be living with it and transmitting to others and not knowing that. So first and foremost is access to quality HIV testing so you can find out your status and understand your own risk. Secondly, if you test positive, then it's accessing services. And there are a lot of obstacles to access. It's less and less about cost of medications or the laboratory assays. Of course, there's a crisis with the health workforce. There aren't enough health workers to do the job. But I think a major impediment, too, is stigma and discrimination. That is still a reality. It's better than it was before treatment was available, but it's still a reality. And that can be one of the leading obstacles to access, and stigma and discrimination, of course, is a complex set of realities, and vary geographically and according to what risk group you come from. And then, of course, to get across the finish line, the treatment has to work. Mm-hmm. The ultimate goal, as people are probably aware now, is suppressing the virus to undetectable levels. And when that happens, you don't transmit the virus to others. It's a miracle that we have this tool at our disposal. We can actually treat somebody so that they can live an essentially normal lifespan, an essentially normal life, adhering to their treatment, of course, but then they also don't transmit the virus to others. So there's a phenomenal opportunity at our fingertips, but it's a matter of getting those three steps completed before that reality can be achieved.
Which almost takes us to something that Mr. Michel Sidibe talked about, which is the 90-90-90 in terms of percentage. If we could access, he talked about if 90% of each of the category that you mentioned could be achieved, that could be a positive outcome in terms of getting closer to eradicating this disease. So speaking of which, the UN mentioned that if the level of commitment could be maintained in terms of, you know, whether it's funding or research and other areas, there is a possibility that HIV/AIDS could be contained, even eradicated. Are you that hopeful? By the year 2030?
Well, I think eradication means it doesn't exist anymore. I think that's probably not the intent of that message. The message is that we can bring it under control to, you know, acceptable levels and very low levels. And you need to break the epidemic down into the different components of the epidemic. One of those components is the mother-child transmission route, which, as your readers may have read, is under control in a number of countries. There's very low levels, you know, less than 1% in some countries of HIV being transmitted from a HIV-positive mother to her baby. So that's an aspect of the epidemic that's very controllable. Mm-hmm. Backing up some years, HIV used to be transmitted through the blood supply on a fairly regular basis. The blood supply, by and large, has been made safe. So that route of transmission has been essentially controlled. It's the sexual transmission part that remains the dilemma. And, of course, there are different modes of sexual transmission that require different approaches before control can be achieved.
Now, you were the chief medical officer for the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR. When you look at the work that PEPFAR has been doing on the ground in a continent like Africa, what can you tell us in terms of the initial goals for this project and what it has been able to achieve?
Well, I think the success of PEPFAR lies very much in leadership, not only at the U.S. government level, where President Bush, who launched it along with Congress, have been, and then followed by President Obama and Congress's support over the ensuing years has been extraordinary. But also local leadership, heads of state now recognizing that we were making an investment, and so they, too, could join us in that investment. And many countries have stepped up and are increasingly investing in their own epidemic. So I think PEPFAR, along with the Global Fund and other efforts, have brought hope to this seemingly overwhelming epidemic, and indeed have placed a great deal of emphasis on achieving results. So the initial, when we started PEPFAR, it was achieving 2 million people on treatment, preventing 7 million infections and caring for 10 million people. And we achieved that and provided feedback to Congress and the American people who were making this multi-billion dollar investment, that their investment paid off. So I think demonstrating results, communicated success, and success breeds success. So, it's been an investment that's been there now for 13, going on 13 years now. My hope is that investment will be maintained, of course, because this epidemic is not over. We still have a long way to go.
That's a good point there. And we are going to take a quick break. And Dr. Kenyon, we will continue our discussion. We'll just take a short break. So please stick with us. It's now time for the news with Sanusi Diallo.
The World Health Organization says the number of new malaria cases in Africa fell 42% from 2000 to 2015. The drop was due in large part to insecticide-treated mosquito nets, indoor spraying, and better access to effective treatment. But this progress could be derailed by a new wave of drug-resistant malaria that's currently affecting Asia. As of last year, five countries in South Asia had reported cases of malaria resistant to the latest treatment, artemisinin-based combination therapies, or ACT. A new study published in The Lancet says 90% of strokes could be prevented. Researcher from Canada, McMaster University, said 10 stroke risk factors that can be modified are responsible for 9 of 10 stroke worldwide. The researchers say that by eliminating hypertension alone, the number of stroke could be nearly halved. The occurrence of stroke could be cut by a further 36% with more physical activities and by 19% by eating a more healthier diet. In addition, reducing alcohol and tobacco intake also reduced the likelihood of strokes, as those reducing stress. A new research center has been opened in Accra to provide services and guidance for persons living with autism. The facility built by Heaven International in Ghana will provide support to children and parents who need information on autism and other intellectual disabilities. Observers say many countries in Africa still lack adequate information and resources on the condition. The well-equipped Heaven International Autism Center will serve as a hub for research, training, and provide answer to persons who need help. And that's the wrap-up of the latest health news.
Welcome back. If you are just joining us, we are discussing HIV/AIDS and taking a look at the International AIDS Conference, which is ongoing right now in Durban, South Africa. And our guest is Dr. Tom Kenyon. He is president and CEO of Project Hope. Dr. Kenyon also worked extensively in fighting the HIV/AIDS epidemic in other capacities, such as chief medical officer for the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. He also was U.S. State Department principal deputy global AIDS coordinator. Dr. Kenyon, it's really a pleasure to have you. Now, one thing that you did is you wrote a blog in light of the AIDS conference. You wrote a blog that was really detailed in terms of some of the challenges and progress and some of your concerns. And I wanted to read a an excerpt of that blog, and I quote, "We must not forget the importance of placing stigma and discrimination, a major obstacle to access, at the top of the agenda," quote. Now, we heard so much about stigma and discrimination being a very, very critical issue when it comes to fighting HIV/AIDS. Can you tell us about some of your experiences in terms of working in this area when you've been working in HIV/AIDS, the experience that you came across and some of the steps we can take to really tackle this issue? Because people talk about stigma and discrimination, and it's been so many years that the HIV/AIDS epidemic has been ongoing, but it's still very much there.
Well, first of all, we talk about a global HIV epidemic, but it's really a summation of local epidemics in, you know, there's 194 countries in the world, and they're all different. And even within a country, there are differences, and the epidemic's not even in countries. So there's no uniform stigma and discrimination. It's very localized, and so it's very important to understand the local context, the local culture, the social factors that drive behavior and social networks, because social networks determine sexual networks. But people feel, for lack of a better word, ashamed of being diagnosed as being HIV positive because it somehow implies that they've been promiscuous.
Yes.
When very often that's not been the case. They've been monogamous, but they, because of the asymptomatic nature of HIV transmission, again, it's silent, people can unknowingly transmit it from one to another and be perfectly monogamous in that relationship. But it implies promiscuity, it brings shame to the individual, to the household, and so forth. So I think we're better than we were, but the challenge now is, as your lead-in to this segment implied, we have certain populations around the world, people who inject drugs, prisoners, the LGBT community, and others who are stigmatized irrespective of HIV. Then you superimpose HIV on that, and it accentuates it even more. So this is really going to require leadership at many different levels, and having sound policies and regulations and laws that don't impede access to programming. If someone is deemed as being engaged in illegal activity, they're not going to come forward for counseling and testing. They're going to continue to hide their status and further transmit the virus underground. So stigma and discrimination not only impede access, but they actually drive transmission. They make the epidemic worse. So it's of paramount importance that this be high on everyone's agenda. It's not a simple matter of putting services and having the HIV drugs, as miraculous as they are, accessible, but you've got to create an enabling environment for them to be accessible.
Now, you mentioned the fact that it's going to require leadership at all levels. When we look at the role of governments, and let me specify to African governments because you have that experience working on the ground in Africa. What do you think that laws and policies can perhaps help in that regard in terms of curbing the discrimination and stigma?
Well, I've heard it both ways. I've known a number of HIV practitioners working in countries, for example, where it's illegal for men to have sex with men. And they say, look, I don't care as a health worker about that. That's not my concern as a health worker. I will work with anyone about their HIV risk. I will work with anyone who's HIV infected, irrespective of their sexual orientation. And those are the real heroes of this response. Part of the difficulty when you elevate it to the political or legislative level is then you create a disruptive environment in which many then people come forward and even make it worse, the discrimination worse. So there's pros and cons. The ideal scenario would be to focus on delivering, in the case of HIV, there may be other reasons around legislation, but in case of HIV, the most important is to make services accessible irrespective of your sexual orientation or how you might be at risk for HIV, including intravenous drug use or being incarcerated. That would be the ideal scenario. But I've seen when you elevate it, it can create problems because it brings others forward who make it more difficult for the health service to deliver the services that they know people need.
Now let's talk about some of the population that live in economically challenged settings, and they have to have their HIV medication, but then they are also dealing with diseases, for example, non-communicable diseases or neglected tropical diseases. There is sometimes competition in terms of priorities. What should I buy? What to buy versus the other? And the fact that one disease can impact the other. What is your reaction to that?
Now, you make an excellent point that HIV is not the only disease out there nor the only health conditions that people are confronting, because the longer they live, the more likely they are to encounter diabetes, hypertension, etc. And this is where the concept of treatment adherence is of paramount importance, because people need individual support to maintain adherence. In this case, antiretroviral therapy, which is incredibly important. If you don't adhere to antiretroviral therapy, there's a high probability you'll develop resistant virus, and there's a probability you'll transmit that resistant virus to others, which only makes the epidemic worse. So I think having an adherence program is critical in any treatment program. One of the projects we're working on is addressing adherence by placing volunteers in the health facility with computer tablets, and they write down, they enter in their computer the people that haven't shown up for their past appointments seem to be defaulting, and then that information gets uploaded into the cloud, and then a field worker out in the village can download that information and find the 4 or 5 or 6 or whatever number of patients in his or her catchment area that aren't coming back for treatment. Then they go and have an individual follow-up session with them, because everyone has different impediments to adherence. It could be at the economic level. It could be they have essential duties to carry out at home, such as tending to the crops or, mm-hmm. or the wildlife or the cattle, whatever that may be. So people confront day-to-day realities and need support from a trained adherence counselor who can help them work through the various issues they face. But no, I'm glad you raised that question, because adherence is a top priority.
And Dr. Kenyon, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. We're out of time. We appreciate your time, Dr. Kenyon.
Well, thank you.
And that was Dr. Tom Kenyon, President and CEO of Project Hope. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in to Health Chat today. Thanks to our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Mudu, in Washington, with producer Jackson Vunganyi, and for the news, Sanusi Diallo. Take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.